more important. Russians have a saying that which is worse? And the answer is both are worse. They're all worse. But if you're going to ask which is going to have the impact for our grandchildren, it's what's going on in Ukraine now.
We only have 30 seconds, but Obama announcing stricter sanctions against Russia. How significant is this? It was a day before the downing of the plane.
I'll repeat what I said before. By resorting to sanctions, Obama reminds us he has no policy toward Ukraine or Russia other than to blame Putin. That's not a policy. That's an attitude.
Well, Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics, New York University, Princeton University. We'll link to his piece in The Nation. His latest book, just out in paperback, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking at Mark Twain House and Museum at Hartford, Connecticut, Monday, July 21st at 7. And then on July 26th on Martha's Vineyard, that's Saturday, 7 p.m., Catherine Cornell Auditorium. In Vineyard Haven. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Steve Martinez, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01 p.m. Coming up is the KBOO Evening News right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Pop Now 2014. From Friday, July 18th until Sunday, July 20th, PDX Pop Now will host bands on two stages, celebrating and supporting all ages music in the city of Portland with bands such as The Bugs, The Portland Cello Project, The Estranged, Purse Candy, Orchestra Pacific Tropical, Summer Cannibals, and many more. PDX Pop will take place at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Avenue in Portland. More information about PDX Pop Now 2014 can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an update on the Israeli ground invasion into the Gaza Strip.
Pro and anti-immigration advocates gather at the Mexican consulate in downtown Portland.
And more wildfires spread around the Pacific Northwest.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 18th, 2014. I'm Theo Burke.
And I'm Liam Delta. Yesterday, the Israeli army sent ground troops into the Gaza Strip in what it calls an attempt to clear out tunnels used for terrorist activities. KBOO's Chris Andre got an update on the events of the past 24 hours with Joe Catron, a journalist and activist in Gaza.
You're actually there. You've worked in Gaza. You've been at the hospitals and seen the results of Israel's efforts. Can you talk a little bit about what you have seen in the past 24 hours?
Sure. Well, experiences here tend to be immediate and localized. It's hard to generalize about what's going on in the Gaza Strip in the whole at a given time, much less over a number of days. For the past 24 hours, I've been either trying to figure out last night the situation at Al-Wafa Hospital. I was not there at the time when it was shelled, partially demolished, and evacuated, so I spent quite a bit of time on the telephone with colleagues who were there. And eventually, I went to the medical complex in Gaza City where the patients had been evacuated. And today I have been helping a friend here who works with a British charity deliver Ramadan food packages in a number of the areas that have been hard hit by Israeli airstrikes. And we've been giving food to people whose homes have been demolished over the past 10 days. We've heard a number of explosions around us. The drone traffic has been constant across the Gaza Strip, including where I am now by the seaport. But today in particular, I've not personally seen any major military activities. I know they're going on elsewhere.
What on earth possessed Israel to do this during Ramadan? This is something that's never reported here in mainstream media anyway, and for that matter, really, and the left, is that this is, we're in Ramadan right now.
Yes, of course, and Ramadan is the Islamic holy month of daytime fasting when no one eats, drinks, smokes, etc., from sunrise to sunset. So it tends to be perhaps a slightly more stressful time of the year already, and the current military offensive certainly isn't helping that for the better. And coupled with the wholesale destruction of homes and displacement of families, I just saw some new statistics from UN OCHA, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, saying that 96,000 people in the Gaza Strip need shelter assistance as a result of the destruction or damage of their homes. So it's a grim Ramadan here for many.
Where do 96,000 people, where do they go? Are they dispersed to the West Bank? This is the hideous irony here is many, for that most citizens of Gaza can't leave, and now you can't stay. So
among those who have been displaced in the current offensive, they've gone to a number of places. Some have remained in their homes. They've been damaged but not completely demolished. There are still walls and roofs standing enough to provide some kind of shelter. That was the case with many of the families we visited this afternoon. Others have moved in with families elsewhere in the Gaza Strip. That's very common here. Extended families tend to be close, and people are eager to help each other, especially in times such as this. The United Nations has opened a number of its schools and other facilities in Gaza City from Jabalia, at the northernmost point where this is happening, stretching into the south as emergency shelters, and many people have moved into those. Others I know are staying in their workplaces if they have offices or shops where they and their families can sleep at night. For the time being, that may be the best option available to them.
So Israel, of course, claiming to take out tunnels that are used by what they called terrorists. What about Fatah? Is there any form of leadership from Fatah? I know that it's been considered notoriously corrupt for quite a while by some Palestinians. Where is Fatah in all of this? And how do people there, the people you speak with, how do they feel about these two sides?
Well, the people here are a political mix. The answers you'll get will depend very much on the person you ask about their opinion. From the West Bank, Ramallah, I understand that Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah leader and president of the Palestinian Authority, has been pushing Israel to end its aggression here, as have, well, everyone in Palestinian society and many international actors as well. Within Gaza at the moment, I think it's fairly safe to say that nearly everyone is united in support of the resistance, and the resistance itself is also united. In the Western media, you'll often read of Hamas firing rockets, but this is extremely misleading. Hamas's militant wing, the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, is of course firing rockets, but so are the armed units of every other Palestinian party that has one, including Fatah. So this is a coalition effort across nearly the entire scope of Palestinian political society. Israel is making it very clear at the moment how little it cares for public opinion, for world opinion. And as a result of that, I think public opinion is inevitably going to continue shifting against it. I don't see many other possible outcomes.
Is there anything that you would recommend for that people here in the West, out here in Cascadia, that what do we do? That's what people want to know, is what do we do?
Well, the immediate thing to do in the present circumstances is, of course, to pressure Israel to end its offensive, to stop massacring people in their homes and children on the beach. United States citizens have a particularly key role to play in that, and I would suggest that everyone call their congressmen, their senators, the president, Barack Obama, and ask why our country is spending $3 billion a year to support this. There are also a number of political actions that can be taken. There are massive numbers of protests now taking place across the world. One website I know of, Samadoun in Canada, their website is samidoun.ca, but they have a very useful running list which they're constantly updating of protests against Israel's aggression that are being held in cities across the globe.
We've been speaking with Joe Catron. He's there in Gaza right now.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre.
We're out here in front of
speaking with Joe Catron for KBOO News.
Yesterday, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution unanimously supporting Israel's attack on Gaza. The resolution passed moments after Israel announced the launch of a ground offensive into the Gaza Strip. The Senate resolution condemns unprovoked rocket fire from Hamas and calls on Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to condemn the attacks against Israel. The resolution does not address Palestinian deaths in Gaza. The Senate resolution passed with 100% support, including the votes of Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley. A gathering of at least four Portland groups sympathetic to the Palestinian cause gathered today in front of Senator Merkley's office on Southwest Salmon Street in Portland to protest the Gaza invasion and Senator Merkley's vote for the Senate resolution. An estimated 70 people waved picket signs and chanted a slogan demanding withdrawal of taxpayer support of Israel. Some of Senator Merkley's staff invited members of the pro-Palestinian groups into the senator's offices to get constituent feedback. KBOO was not allowed to observe that meeting, and the senator's staff declined to make any comments to the press. KBOO's Jamie Partridge spoke with Rod Such from both the Portland chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace and also spoke with Sarah Levy of Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights.
We're out here in front of one main place, the office of Senator Jeff Merkley. Protesters from Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights are here talking with two representatives, Mark Siegel, field representative, and Gene Atkins, staff. So the Americans United for Palestinian Equal Rights and Jewish Voice for Peace are here today demonstrating out in front of Senator Merkley's office. There are several dozen people now that have gathered, and there are many signs that say stop Israeli occupation and apartheid. Who are we talking to?
I'm Rod Such, and I'm with Jewish Voice for Peace, Portland chapter, and also Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights.
And you're here to send a message to Senator Merkley about...
Absolutely. We're here to send a message to him about his support for a resolution that in the Senate that backs Israel 100%, doesn't say anything about Palestinian human rights, and basically calls for no recognition of the Palestinian Unity Government.
So how do people get connected? Is there a website or a...
Yes, there is. There is a website. Just search for Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. And at the website, you can sign up to take part in the picketing. The last Saturday of every month, we picket outside Target, the downtown Target store.
Sarah Levy with Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, and she's holding a sign that says, and she's also with the International Socialist Organization. She's carrying a sign that says, over 274 dead in Gaza. Senator, how many will it take? End U.S. trade with Israel and demand a weapons embargo. So why are you here today, Sarah? Tell us about it.
I'm here today because, should I hold it? Or because over 274 Gazans have already been killed, and that's according to UN figures, that's about 80% civilians, including over 50 children. And while U.S. is saying that they're bombing tunnels and bombing Hamas hotspots, the fact of the matter is that they're bombing schools and hospitals and homes.
That was KBOO's Jamie Partridge at the protests in Gaza in downtown Portland.
Today, in the first debate in Oregon's 2014 gubernatorial race, Democratic Governor John Kitzhaber took on Republican Dennis Richardson. The questions for the debate were crafted by members of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Candidates were asked about issues ranging from marijuana legalization to education. In Richardson's opening comments, he addressed the amount of vacation time that Governor Kitzhaber has taken while in office. Kitzhaber responded by describing his success in a polarized government. When asked about driver cards for undocumented immigrants, the candidates expressed very different opinions. Richardson says that the system is being taken advantage of. Kitzhaber believes it helps protect immigrants' human rights.
115 Syrian government soldiers were killed during a day-long battle over the Shayir gas field in central Syria on Thursday. This has been the deadliest battle so far between Islamic militants and forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. The assault on the gas field began with a suicide bombing and an attack on army checkpoints in the Homs province on Thursday. The militants seized the field after 12 hours of intense clashes with the government soldiers. This has been the largest operation against the Assad regime in the Homs province. The fate of more than 200 people captured in the oil field's facilities is still unknown.
The Columbia newspaper reported this week that Washington's Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council voted 8-1 to approve the Port of Vancouver site for heavy industrial use. That's good news for the Tesoro and Savage corporations and their proposed oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver. Those companies started a major PR push last week, arguing that the $200 million project is both safe and economically viable. According to the Columbian, the question of whether the company should actually get to build and operate their project is still far from settled. While the site may be suitable for industrial uses, approval for this specific use, an oil terminal, is not assured. Such approval will depend on many other factors and will be decided later. Environmentalists oppose the project because the proposed oil terminal will enable over 360,000 barrels of crude oil a day by rail and barge. That's four trains a day, each train having a length of 1.5 miles.
Over the past month, the Obama administration has turned its attention to the heavy influx of children from Central America migrating into the southern United States. This development prompted advocates on both sides of this issue, both in support of increased immigration and those against it, to protest outside of the Mexican consulate in downtown Portland today. KBOO's Jamie Partridge spoke with two members of Oregonians for Immigration Reform and with Marco Mejia from Jobs for Justice.
Jamie Partridge, KBOO News. I'm out here on the corner of 12th and Jefferson in front of the Mexican consulate. There's a group of there's a couple dozen protesters out here. I'm standing with a group carrying some American flags on the corner here, and I'm talking with, what's your name?
Leniel.
Leniel, and why are you here today, Leniel?
I'm here because a member of my family was, a relative of mine, was sexually assaulted by an illegal alien who was deported in February of this year. But for all I know, he's back because we will not defend the border.
And you're here today. What is the message that you're trying to get out today?
That American citizens have rights too, and I'm getting tired of being treated like a second-class citizen in my country in favor of people who use things like ethnic privilege or poverty to simply muscle their way into this country. We have poor who need those jobs.
Thank you, Leniel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking to John Stark.
I'm here because I think families should be united. We've got parents that are sending their kids over thousands of miles to dangerous land to come here to take our education and our health care. And I think we should send them back to their mama and daddies.
John Stark, thank you very much. By the way, those folks that were carrying American flags didn't have any signs. I'm looking at a banner that says Defying Borders, Reuniting Families, Building a Movement. And I'm talking with Marco Mejia, who's got a T-shirt on that says Undocumented, Unafraid, Unapologetic. Why are you here today, Marco?
Well, we're here today because we are defending the sense of justice and fairness and understanding about the root causes of migration. And this group, the anti-immigrant and a hate group called Oregonians for Institutionalized Racism, Oregonians for Immigration Reform, which is the same, are here protesting in the consulate Mexican consulate about the kids that have crossed the border and about the issue of immigration. And I think that that shows the ignorance of them, because these kids, a few of them are Mexican, but most of them are Central Americans.
Now, these are 57,000 unaccompanied minors plus
single parents
with their children that since January have crossed the border in a huge surge into this country from Central America. Not much has been said about why this is happening, except that the Democrats and Republicans seem to be falling all over each other about who can deport them back the fastest. Why is this happening, Marco?
Well, the thing is that, you know, this is not something new. What is new is that they are increasing in the number. Immigration migration has been happening for a long time, as you know, and everyone knows. The problem is that they are politicizing this issue to make it a big deal against Obama, because, you know, it's this is conservatives. But anyway, the problem here, as I see, is that it is happening now, and nobody, or not nobody, but many people, like the ones that have called for an anti-immigrant protest today, don't understand that actually the immigrants that come here, these kids that come here, those single parents that come here, are a consequence of a system that the United States has created and that has been developing with the intervention that they have with the trade agreements, the free trade agreements throughout Central America and South America and the whole world, and all the violence and the wars that they have been supporting and financing in Central America. This is that consequence of that, and they don't understand that. They talk about rule of law, but the United States is the one that has been breaking all possible laws, internal and external. By the way, these kids cannot be sent back, thanks to a law that George Bush put on place, right? Their own laws, and they're talking about rule of law. So they
can't be sent back because they possibly qualify for refugee status because of the violence and poverty that they're fleeing.
Exactly, and especially unaccompanied minors.
And as I understand it, many of those are being sheltered in various places, not just on the border. And in fact, some of the children are coming to Portland.
Yes, they're distributing them around the country because, as you said, they're in the thousands of them, tens of thousands. So they need to find places where they have capacity to house them until they go through the process. You know, this is not just about an immigration crisis. This is a humanitarian crisis. These kids are refugees for violence, for poverty, for other things, and they are not accompanied. They're by themselves, and they're minors. So we just need to respond to that crisis as it is, as a humanitarian crisis.
Thank you, Marco Mejia.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Partridge for KBOO News.
Oregon continues to struggle with the outbreak of wildfires. The 15 in Oregon have prompted the call-up of over 6,000 firefighters. Meanwhile, wildfires in Washington have prompted the declaration of a state of emergency in 20 eastern Washington counties. The declaration allows officials to get help from the National Guard if needed. State officials worry that extreme conditions and a lack of resources in the Northwest could hamper efforts to fight the fires. The wildfires have already destroyed about 100 homes in rural north central Washington. So far, no injuries have been reported.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Today, Bread and Roses is discussing the Healthy Plate Project, a barter program for local produce. At 7 p.m., it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with a high of 84, and Sunday we'll see a pattern of mostly clouds and a high of 75. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 30 counts per minute in North Portland, 26 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 36 CPM. And Hanford, Washington has a count of 32 CPM. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, the Spanish Civil War began with an uprising by nationalist forces in Spanish Morocco in 1936. On July 18, 1994, the Rwandan Patriotic Front took power in northwestern Rwanda, thereby ending the Rwandan genocide. And finally, just last year, the city government of Detroit filed for bankruptcy, the largest municipality to do so in U.S. history. The quote of the day comes from Hunter S. Thompson, so-called gonzo writer and journalist, who was born on this day in 1937. He said, "Yesterday's weirdness is tomorrow's reason why."
It's 5:26. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In my unstinting effort to keep you up to the moment in the digital world of what's happening next, allow me to introduce you to two terms you might not have encountered in your own busy world. First comes the Internet of Things. This refers to the bundle of smartphones, smart cars, smart watches, smart homes, smart clothes, and smart everythings that supposedly are smarter than you and are supposed to make your life easier. Next is connectivity, which refers to the brave new world in which we humanoids connect to our products and they connect to each other. Both terms were buzzing around a recent conference at which Apple, the giant of gizmos, announced a new software package called HomeKit that puts your iPhone in charge of your house. For example, when you're headed home from work, this phone will unlock your door, open the garage, turn on the lights, adjust the thermostat, start the oven, fire up the barbecue, and get the daiquiri blender going. How handy is that? However, aside from the fact that none of these tasks seem burdensome enough to warrant internet intervention, my question is, handy for whom? Thieves would surely appreciate the convenience of hacking into your HomeKit system to have it unlock your doors for them. And NSA, the FBI, and other snoops will gladly rig your toaster to spy on you. Perhaps the worst perversion of smart technology, however, is one already being contemplated by Google. Using the connectivity of thermostats, ovens, light fixtures, etc. to transmit digital ads directly into our homes. Oh, the horror! This is Jim Hightower saying, before we connect the privacy of our homes to the Internet of Things, let's ponder what other things come with this gee-whiz technology. To learn more, connect with the Electronic Privacy Information Center at epic.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Garcia declared Florida's ban on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional on Wednesday, ruling on legal challenges brought by gay couples in Monroe County. The circuit court judge's ruling applies only to Monroe County, one of Florida's 67 counties. Judge Garcia contended the same-sex marriage ban approved by Florida voters in 2008 violates the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees equal protection under the law. On Thursday afternoon, the State Attorney General's office filed an appeal of the ruling, saying that Florida law defines marriage as solely between a man and a woman. Judge Garcia announced that marriage licenses could be issued to gay couples on Tuesday at the earliest.
The U.S. Bureau of Prisons has rejected the Army's request to transfer Private Chelsea Manning to a civilian facility. This decision means that her gender transition will begin in military prison. The decision raises questions about the level of treatment available to Manning and at what point the private will be transferred from the all-male prison to a female facility. The former intelligence analyst was sentenced in August for 6 Espionage Act violations and 14 other offenses. This was after Manning gave WikiLeaks more than 700,000 secret military and State Department documents and battlefield video while working in Iraq in 2009 and 2010. Manning's treatment request is the first by a transgender military inmate.
The U.S. House voted to make it easier for banks to do business with legal providers of medical marijuana. This vote rejected a Republican move to block the Treasury Department from allowing banks to take deposits from marijuana businesses in those states where it is legal. The Treasury Department's existing guidelines to allow banks to take those deposits was intended to give banks confidence that they could provide banking services to legal marijuana businesses without running afoul of federal money laundering laws. Many banks are still reluctant to do so because marijuana dealing is still against federal law. As a result, many marijuana operators stockpile cash, a situation that shop owners say is dangerous to their public safety. Federal money laundering convictions can mean decades in prison, but the Treasury guidelines and now the U.S. House action relieves these concerns for banks in those states. The House vote demonstrates a loosening of anti-marijuana sentiment on Capitol Hill. A coalition of 46 mostly GOP moderates and libertarian-leaning Republicans joined with all but 7 Democrats to defeat the attempt to block the Treasury guidelines.